The Big Journey from Creation to New Creation. This is a Bible teaching series that will take you all the way through the Bible from the creation account in Genesis to John's vision of a new creation in the book of Revelation. This series is brought to you by creationtonewcreation.com. In this second talk, we'll continue unpacking the first two chapters of Genesis. When reading this passage, we may be tempted to focus on how it squares with modern scientific theories. For example, were the creation days really just 24 hours long? And what about the theory of evolution? Now, these questions are obviously very important, but these opening chapters of Genesis go deeper than geology and biology. They tell us about our Creator God. They explain who we humans are and why God created us. They tell us about our relationship to God. They unveil the mystery of marriage, and they show that we are to care for and rule the natural world. These are the things we'll be focusing on. In the previous talk, we saw that the creation account divides into three parts. The first verse of Genesis tells us that God created the heavens and the earth. Then, in verse 2 of Genesis 1, God zooms in onto earth. In 6 days he transforms it into a world full of order and life and beauty. Then, on the seventh day, he rests. Then in Genesis 2, verses 4 to 25, God zooms us in still further to a specific region on earth called Eden. He gives us an intimate and more detailed view of how he made mankind and how he created a garden paradise for mankind to live in. Let's begin at the very beginning, the majestic opening verse of the Bible. I'm using the English Standard Version. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. It's most likely that this verse is describing God's first creative step. So God's first step was to create the heavens and the earth. This probably means the entire universe, the heavens and the sun, moon and stars. It may also include the invisible heavenly realms. Then, in verse 2, God, so to speak, zooms in to a specific part of the universe, the earth. He describes the earth to us as it was at that point in time. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Now, if the sun, moon and stars already existed, how come the earth was in darkness? Perhaps because the earth was shielded from their light. It seems likely that the earth was enveloped with a thick canopy of water vapour, a dense cloud that completely shut out light. You may once or twice have experienced a day when massive thunderclouds shut out the sunlight so much that street lights shone even during the day. Well, that seems to be just a taste of what it was like on Earth then. So, if you had been present there on the surface of the Earth, you would have been in total darkness. And it's that perspective that best explains the creation account. We seem to be viewing the creation events unfold around us as if we ourselves were present there on the surface of the Earth. So, using that perspective, we can now describe what happened during the 6 creation days. The earth is a lifeless globe, blanketed with unending ocean. All is black as night. No light pierces the darkness. But God is there. The Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. In Deuteronomy 32 verse 11, we find that same word translated hovering used of an eagle fluttering watchfully over its young. Like an eagle fluttering over its nest, the Holy Spirit is hovering over the earth, ready to bring light and life and order and beauty to a dark and empty world. The earth is formless, so God gives it form. He does this on the first 3 creation days. And the earth is empty, so from the 3rd to the 6th day, God fills it. On the first 3 days, God brings order out of chaos. He divides and organizes things. He creates light and separates it from darkness. He separates the waters from the sky and the sea from the land. but the sun and moon and stars don't yet appear. It seems that the earth is still enveloped by a dense vapour cloud. The sun's rays now penetrate this cloud and bathe the world in light, but the sun, moon and stars themselves remain hidden, just as they are on a cloudy day or night. Then, from the third to the sixth day, God fills the earth. He fills the land with vegetation, the sky with sun and moon and stars, the air with birds, and the seas and the land with all kinds of living creatures. Notice that God made the sun and moon and stars on day four. Light, of course, already existed. Perhaps God now focuses and concentrates the light into sun and moon and stars. But there may be another explanation. The Hebrew word for made in verse 16 is asah. This word can, according to context, be translated in a variety of ways. For example, make or prepare. It can also be translated appoint. It's possible that God doesn't create the heavenly bodies at this point. They already existed. Rather, the waters above the sky, which seem to be the clouds, break up. The sun can now be clearly seen by day, and the moon and stars by night. Now they're appointed to rule the day and night respectively. They can now be used, as verse 14 suggests, to track the passage of the days, the seasons, and the years. On the final creation day, we overhear God speaking. Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion. God doesn't speak like this at any other point in creation. He is creating something new and different from anything he had made before. He is bringing into being a creature in his own image, mankind. We'll explore what it means to be in God's image in the next session. All three persons of the Trinity were involved in creating the universe. The Father purposed and designed it. He created it through the Son. And the universe was created by the agency of the Holy Spirit, whom we saw here hovering over the waters. And when God says, "Let us make man in our image," we seem to be overhearing the triune God deliberating with himself before executing his creative masterstroke. In the first chapter of Genesis, God uses two words for create or make. One of them is bara. This word, as used here, indicates that God is creating something quite new or different. We encounter this word, bara, three times in chapter 1. Bara is used in verse 1 for the creation of the heavens and earth from nothing. It's then used in verse 21 for the creation of the first animals, the creatures that live in the water and the sky. This tells us that these creatures are distinctly different from anything God had created before, including plants. This in turn suggests that plants and animals didn't evolve from the same primordial organisms. Finally, bara is used in verse 27 for the creation of mankind. Mankind is a different kind of being from animals. We are similar to them in certain ways, of course. For example, our bodies share numerous design features with mammals. But there's a fundamental difference between us and the animal kingdom. And this also indicates that humans don't share a common ancestor with animals. So God finishes all his creative work. He pronounces it very good. On the seventh day, God rests. Of course, God is not tired. It's simply that all is finished. The earth's formlessness is replaced by order. Its emptiness is filled. All is now exactly as he wanted it to be. In Genesis 2, verses 4 to 25, our focus changes. We zoom in to a specific location on earth. We're now in the land of Eden. God gives us a closer, more intimate view of how he created mankind. He tells us, too, about the garden where he and mankind would live together. Eden was undoubtedly somewhere in the Middle East. Here in Eden, God plants a garden with beautiful and fruitful trees. A river flowed out of Eden to water the garden, and there it divided and became four rivers. It seems most likely that the river flowed through the garden and then divided into four channels. This would mean that the garden was upstream of the rivers, and thus on higher ground. Perhaps it was somewhere in present-day Armenia. If the garden was indeed on higher ground, this is doubtless very significant. Through the Bible we find that hills and mountains are often significant. For instance, Solomon builds God's temple on a mountain, Mount Zion. It was God's holy mountain. We read about God's holy mountain in a number of places in the Old Testament. For example, in Zechariah 8 verse 3, we read, "Jerusalem shall be called the faithful city, and the mountain of the Lord of hosts, the holy mountain." So it's likely that the garden was on high ground. It was God's holy mountain where he walked with mankind. God made himself at home in Eden. He walked with Adam and Eve there. Of course, God still lived in heaven. Indeed, even heaven itself cannot contain him. But now he made his home here on earth with mankind as well. In Genesis 2, God gives us more detail about how he created man. He formed Adam from the dust of the ground. Then he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. God gave this man-shaped lump of clay the kiss of life. As Adam awoke into consciousness, he found God, so to speak, bending over him and lovingly kissing him into being. Then in verse 18 we read that God says, "It is not good." This startles us. Till now he has pronounced everything to be good. Now something was not good. Adam was alone. So God made animals and birds and brought them to Adam to see what he would call them. Some of the animals that Adam named could indeed be his faithful companions and helpers, but Adam still needed a real helpmate. He needed one with whom he could truly be united and share his life and his work. So God created a woman from Adam's side. We'll look more closely at man and woman in the next session. For now, we'll leave Matthew Henry to share his perceptive and lovely insight with us. The woman was made of a rib out of the side of Adam, not made out of his head to rule over him, nor out of his feet to be trampled upon by him, but out of his side to be equal with him, under his arm to be protected, and near his heart to be beloved. Adam and Eve were both naked and without shame. This means more than just that they wore nothing. Their relationship with each other and with God was open and transparent. They had nothing to hide from each other. They had nothing to hide from God. It has been suggested that, before their sin, Adam and Eve were, in fact, clothed, not with garments, but with glory. But that glory was lost after they sinned. So God created this beautiful world that we live in, and ourselves as its crowning glory. So what is God's creation like? Firstly, it is good. When he finished his creative work, God declared the universe to be very good. This physical world and material things can occupy an unhealthy dominance in people's lives, and material things can be used for evil purposes. But they are not intrinsically evil. On the contrary, they are intrinsically good because they were created by our good God. Our own physical bodies are good too. We may use them to commit sin, but our bodies are not sinful in and of themselves. On the contrary, the physical body of a child of God is God's temple. And when our lives are over, we believers won't live in some insubstantial, ethereal world. The eternal world will undoubtedly be very different from this world, but we can be sure it will be at least as tangible and solid and substantial as the one we live in now. And the goodness of physical, bodily existence was endorsed supremely by this astonishing fact: God himself became a man with a physical body. And after his ascension to his Father's right hand in heaven, Jesus is still fully man as well as fully God. He still has a glorified physical body. So the universe is good. Secondly, the universe reveals God. The psalmist sang that the heavens declare the glory of God and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Paul tells us that God's eternal power and divine nature have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. The telescope and microscope and our naked eye discover exquisite beauty and order that can only come from our creative and omnipotent God. Thirdly, our universe is centred on this little planet we call Earth. Earth may or may not be at the exact geographical centre of the universe, but it is most certainly at the centre of God's purposes for creation. God created the sun, moon and stars for the sake of this little planet. They provide its light and warmth and energy on which all its life depends. Compared with the incomprehensible vastness of the universe, Earth is a fragile, insignificant speck. That was so tellingly portrayed by the famous photograph of planet Earth taken in 1990 by Voyager 1. That photograph, now named Pale Blue Dot, was captured from a distance of about 6 billion kilometres from the Earth. Our planet appears on that photo as a tiny dot against the vastness of space. Yet it is on this tiny dot that God created a being made in his image. It was here that God himself became man and lived and suffered and died and rose again. Here, on our fragile and seemingly insignificant planet, God altered forever the destiny of the whole creation, both visible and invisible. And the most astonishing and wonderful thing about Earth is this. God made this Earth to live here himself. Of course, God lives in heaven, too, but he also makes his home here on Earth with mankind. In the beginning, God walked in the Garden of Eden. Later, he dwelt among his people in the tabernacle and the temple. Now he dwells in his redeemed people, the church. One day he will live on the new earth with his people forever. In our next talk, we'll look more closely at mankind. We humans are the crowning glory of God's creation. We're made in his image. What does this mean, and how are we made? These are the questions we'll try to address.